Morning, and welcome to week four. If you don't have one of the prayer books, one of the Sidurim, maybe some could be passed down, because we are going to make use of them, I expect. Again, as I did last week, I'm going to dedicate my part in the class today to Aviv Ben Paula, who is the soldier with whom I am partnered. I know that quite a few of you emailed me that you've also done this Shmira project, and I think it's a very important thing to do. So I applaud those who do it. I'm also going to offer the following at the end, because quite a few people have said that they'd like to have a chance to also talk about what's going on in Israel, and frankly, I'm spending entirely too much time at this point on websites debunking things and responding to things, and it's too much time, but on the other hand, it's not enough, because I think it's something that is important to do. So for those who are able and want to stick around at the end, I will also stay around at the end to discuss that and to talk about some of what's going on and some of the important responses, because the stuff that we're seeing online and the stuff that's coming out in the media, while I happen to believe, and maybe I'm just naive, I happen to believe that journalists, by and large, are trying to do the right thing and are largely, unfortunately, just ignorant. There's just an incredible amount of ignorance. There are very short memories in which that which happened a year ago never happened. And so I think that there's quite a bit that's worth discussing. So at the end, I will stay around for that, as well as to recite a little bit of Tehillim of Psalms from here. I think it would also be appropriate. So again, that we'll do at the end. I also wanted to mention, because I haven't seen it that well publicized, so I want to make sure that you know, Thursday night, DJ Schneeweiss from the Israeli Consulate is going to be speaking at Congregation B'nai Torah. That's on Patricia, a little bit north of here, corner of Patricia and Bathurst, basically. So he's going to be giving an update on what's going on and a look towards the future. That is going to be Thursday night at B'nai Torah, I believe at 7:30? Right? 7:30? Okay, so that's something to be aware of. And finally, I got word from Loretta that I will be teaching in the fall, it looks like, for Toronto Morasha at Beth Emeth, and the topic, appropriately enough, although I really hope it'll be done by then, is Jews at War. And that'll be a six-week topic, and it'll start on October 22nd. You'll get information about it, not to worry. If I have your email address from this class, then you'll get information. So I wanted to first follow up on an item from from last class that someone asked me about in an email, because I thought that I had prefaced it properly, but maybe I didn't. And that is just to explain the word Amidah, right, which we referred to constantly last week as the central portion of of Jewish prayer, is the part for which one stands. It's found on page 103 in these books. We're not going to look at it yet, but it's the part for which we stand with our feet together and recite quietly, and then afterwards the chazan, the leader, repeats it, made up of originally 18 blessings and then 19 blessings. That's what I was referring to when I talked about the Amidah and the way that it developed. Okay, so our first week we talked about prayer biblically and how it is biblically, it's spontaneous, it is said anywhere with any formulation apparently, and later on in the text of the Chumash, of the Bible, you find that there is more of an idea of a formal prayer. We gave a couple of examples. The second week, we talked about how after the Jews come back to Israel from their exile in Babylon, when they were going to build the second temple about 2,500 years ago, the group that is in charge, the great assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, they create, number one, they institute communal prayer as a means of bringing people together and enhancing the possibility that God will listen to their prayer as a nation, as a community. And they also create a minimum fixed text for the Amidah to guarantee that people will say the things they need to say in proper Hebrew. And it also boosts morale for the ragtag returnees. In the third week, we began to look at what was involved in creating the Amidah, so the goal of providing structure for a relationship with God at a time when there was no mimetic tradition that people could emulate from their parents, as well as the way that they wove in verses from Tanakh as a means of anchoring Jewish identity in the text of the Tanakh that is our heritage. So what I want to look at today, and thank you everybody who voted, option number two had a clear majority. Those who saw the email that I sent out know what I'm talking about. But what I want to do is look at the elements of our Siddur, of our prayer book, that lead up to the Amidah, and how they came to be there historically, and philosophically, what they're there for, what they are meant to accomplish for us. So if you take a look at source number one on your sheet, you see I refer you to the art scroll that you should have, pages 19 to 21. Take a fast look, please, because that's going to be necessary in order to explain what we're about to see. The opening portion of the Siddur of the prayer book, and for those who want more, there are more of them, you know, there on the shelf anyone doesn't have. But the opening portion consists of blessings which don't really have to be recited in the synagogue as part of formal prayer. They actually historically were recited when one got up in the morning, washed up, got dressed. So there are blessings that are about putting on one's shoes, that are putting on one's clothes, standing up out of bed, starting to walk. There are blessings for all sorts of events that occur during the morning. Today, they tend to be recited in the synagogue, grouped together, and they're there in the prayer book as though, you know, one is going to show up in the synagogue and say them all together. But what I have here, and I wanted you to see, is on page 19, and it leads on to page 21, is something called Birchot HaTorah, Blessings on the Torah. Looking at them, you may recognize part of them as the blessing that's recited before the Aliyah, when one is actually called up to the Torah. These are meant to be recited before one studies Torah. Usually they're recited in the morning and they cover Torah study for the entire day. It's meant to elevate the study of Torah from just absorbing information to a religious experience. That's what it's there for. And it's so important that we're actually taught that until one has said these blessings, one should not study. Like, it's really meant to be the entree into studying. The first two paragraphs are about the study of Torah. Those are the blessings. And then after the first two paragraphs, you see sections of Torah. So it's like the person who made the blessings on study then launches into study. So I show this to you, number one, because it's good to know about. And you know, this is an important piece of our liturgy. But I show it to you more because of source number two on your sheets. Source number two is a response from Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, in which he was asked a question that is only tangentially related. The question he was asked was, since we say that the blessings I just showed you are meant to be recited once for the entire day, what if somebody gets up in the middle of the night? There's a practice of getting up in the middle of the night, it's called Tikkun Chatzot, to pray for the destruction of, to pray not on behalf of, but to pray because of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem. There are all sorts of prayers that are recited in the middle of the night. There's also the set of prayers called the Slichot, which are recited on fast days, but they're also recited around the time of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. And the question is, if you get up in the middle of the night and you're going to be reciting these prayers, do you first say the blessing on Torah study? Are you covered by the blessing that you said the previous morning? If you say it now, does that cover you for the following day? That's the question, the set of questions really that are put to him. And he begins his response by noting the following, source number two. One must recite blessings upon the Torah before reading it, even before reading just one verse. And then he says, there is no distinction between reading as a plea and request, or anything, meaning anything else. One must recite the blessings. In other words, the statement that he makes is that reading a biblical verse, whether you're reading it to study it, or whether you're reading it as a prayer, either way, that is considered to be a form of study such that these blessings are supposed to be recited. So he's suggesting here that prayer which incorporates biblical verse is still a form of Torah study. Even as you say the words, you are learning them. That's the idea. Now, some have pointed out in previous weeks that there are those who have the habit of just sort of racing through their prayers, and you sort of wonder, what form of study is that? But my response would be, well, that's not what prayer is supposed to be. And that's not what Maimonides has in mind. He's talking about somebody who is reciting the words and thinking about the words, and although it's meant as prayer, nonetheless, he says it counts as study. You follow what he's saying? Leah. Right. So that's exactly what he's asked to address. And the general approach, just to, you know, I can't leave you hanging on the question, the general approach is to assume that it goes from when one rises in the morning until one lies down on the bed to go to sleep at night. So if a person is riding on the train and nods off, or they put their head down at work for 10 minutes or whatever, that doesn't count. That doesn't interrupt it. There's some debate if someone takes a serious nap during the day. Like a person's out for an hour and a half, 2 hours, then there's some debate. In terms of the person who gets up early in the morning, so the assumption is yes, they should make the new blessing, and then assuming they're not going back to sleep for a real sleep, it will cover the rest of the day afterwards. That's in a nutshell. Yeah.
To reverse his point, though, isn't study considered a form of prayer?
So that's where I wanted to go. Thank you, Marilee. That's exactly the question I wanted to ask. What about the other way around? If a person recites biblical verses, does that constitute a form of prayer? What would you say? I hear a yes already. Why? Yeah, go ahead.
It would depend on what your attitude is to studying the Torah. If you're studying the Torah and thinking of it as prayer, then it is prayer. If you're studying it as a history lesson, then it's not prayer.
Right. So the modern Hasidim, in their early days, end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, spoke a lot about this. The idea that even when one is engaged in study, it is an act of devotion, and one is supposed to be thinking about God, and the act of study should be something one engages in, specifically having in mind, I'm thinking about God and want to get closer to God. So as you're suggesting, the kavanah, the intent that you have going in, is going to potentially turn this into prayer. And I think that's certainly one approach. What if you're just studying it intellectually? You want to learn it, or even religiously, but as a religious duty of study. In other words, I am a Jew, therefore I'm supposed to know Judaism, therefore I'm studying the Torah. Does that then become prayer?
Marilyn. I think it can't hurt.
I'd agree with that. Marilyn says it can't hurt. So the truth of the matter is that generally speaking, this is an academic question. In other words, it is what you want it to be. If you want to draw closer to God this way, and you are conversing with God with it, then who's to tell you you're not? Obviously, you are. So from that perspective, this is academic. But the reason I ask the question is because I think it cuts to the core of what a large chunk of this book is doing here. All of the sections that lead up to the Amidah are built from biblical verses. Largely, although not exclusively, chapters of Psalms. We're going to see three portions. We're going to see first Karbanot, a set of verses that speak about the offerings that are brought in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, when there is one. The second section called Psukei DeZimra, which is verses from Psalms and elsewhere in Tanakh that speak of praise for God. And then third, we're going to see the Shema. All three of these sections precede the Amidah, and the question is, we're reading biblical verses, is this prayer? And if not, what's it doing in my Siddur? What's it doing in my prayer book? It's called a prayer book for a reason. Granted that that's not what the word Siddur means, right? Siddur means order, arrangement, correct, like the Seder. And we'll come back to that, I hope, at the end, because I did want to spend some time on the history of the development of the Siddur, at least on some level. It's certainly important for us to know about. So from my perspective, the verses that we have that lead up to the Amidah, these three sections I just mentioned, are not necessarily prayer, but they are liturgy, ritual, which enables us to approach God in prayer in the Amidah. And that's what I want to demonstrate. So the first stage of this, and I gave you the page numbers on your sheet, is found in the books that you have in the Sidurim. Sidurim is the plural of Sidur. From page 33 to 45. There are things before it. Those are the blessings that I mentioned earlier. And also worthy of looking at, but we just can't do everything. But page 33 to page 45 is the section known as the Karbanot, or as it's translated, you see it here, the offerings. And what you see, if you flip through it, is a set of verses that talk about what's done every day in a Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. So it begins with the Kohanim, the priests, going in and washing their hands from the sink to prepare. And there is, in fact, traditional Jewish practice of washing one's hands before going into the synagogue to mirror that, even if your hands are clean. It's a matter of preparation for service. Then they would clean off the altar. That's the taking of the ashes found on page 35. Then you find the Tamid on page 37. Those are the verses about the offering brought every morning and evening in the temple. Then the incense that is brought, that takes you through page 39 all the way on to page 41. And then on page 43, you get a summary of the order of what's done every day in the temple. And that concludes with a couple of prayers that take you on to page 45. 46, 47 is already something different. So the idea of using biblical text here, the text of the Karban, as part of something we're going to say every day, goes back to a verse in the prophet Hosea. Hosea found in source number 3. Hosea is a prophet towards the end of the first temple period. You may recognize this verse. If you don't yet recognize this verse, I hope that you will in September. Because this is part of the Haftorah that is read on Shabbat Shuvah, the Shabbat between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. So if you didn't recognize it already, God willing, you will when it's read in the synagogue in a couple of months. Because for sure, remember everything for a couple of months, right? If you take a look at source number 3, he says the following. He says, "Kichu imachem devarim v'shuvu el Hashem." Bring words with you and return to God. Imru elav, say to him, say to God, "Forgive all sin and accept the good, and may our lips complete our bowls." The bowls are a reference to the Karban, to the offering. Our lips are a reference to our speech, the words that we bring to God. And he pleads with God and he says, we should actually turn to God and say, "Forgive our sins and let our speech complete our offerings." Now, he's living at a time when they have offerings. There still is a Beit HaMikdash. There still is a temple. But he says there has to be an emphasis on prayer as well and speech, which completes the bowls. But look what the Talmud does with his statement. I actually didn't bring the Talmudic passage. I brought another version of it that appears in the Midrash in source number 4, in which God turns to the Jew and says, "Since you involve yourselves in studying them being the offerings, the Karbanot, I consider it as though you had actually brought them." Study about the offering, and it's as though you had brought the offering. Now, that's a very odd thing to say, because, you know, thinking about something doesn't actually mean you did it, right? That's like when I ask one of my kids, "So did you bring up the milk from the fridge in the basement?" "I thought about it." Like, thinking about it doesn't mean you did it. So why do you get credit for reciting the verses if you didn't actually bring the offering?
We don't all bring offerings. We don't all bring offerings. First two.
Yeah.
Perhaps the priest or the Kohen.
So Marilyn points out that we don't actually have a personal obligation to bring an offering in the temple. That's true. There are circumstances where one does, but that's not necessarily going to be on a daily basis. However, The offerings that we read about in these verses are communal offerings, and therefore they are understood as an obligation for all of us, not just for the priest, but it's actually a national obligation. That's a good point. So, what are we accomplishing by reading verses? We're not actually bringing the offering. Certainly, one would not suggest that during First Temple times, when they are bringing these offerings, Hosea is saying, forget it, stop the offerings, just read about them. Because that would have required a lot more real estate than one verse in a book, in chapter 14. For him to make that kind of a statement, that would be rather dramatic.
Go ahead. We are bringing ourselves, we are bringing our intent, and we are bringing our not just the physical offering, but the intent of offering in order to commune with God.
Right. Very good. And in fact, I think that matches very nicely with what Maimonides has to say, not about this practice, but about offerings in general. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, Maimonides is dealing with a problem. And it's a significant problem. The passage right before what I brought you here in number 5, he quotes verses from various prophets, going all the way back to Yirmiyahu, to Jeremiah, and continuing through the 12 smaller books that are called Treyasar. He brings a series of verses in which prophets turn to the Jewish people and say, God doesn't want your offerings. He never wanted them. He never told you you should bring them, which is just flat out not true. I mean, we have an entire book of Leviticus, which, you know, if you take that out, biblical text is a lot shorter, which talks about various offerings to be brought for specific occasions. You can't tell me God never wanted offerings. So Maimonides, in his Guide of the Perplexed, Moreh Nevuchim, in source number 5, offers the following explanation. This is a piece of a larger passage. I wanted to bring a larger one. I thought I wouldn't have space. The truth is I could have, but it's the way it goes. He says, the primary object, meaning the purpose of bringing offerings, is that you should know me, God, and serve no other. And I will be your God, and you will be my nation. I instructed you in all of these rituals in my name, until the name of idolatry would be erased, and the principle of my oneness would remain, so that this principle would endure in your hands. He says, I told you to bring all of these offerings. I told you to perform these temple rituals, the sacrifices, the korbanot, because I wanted you to have a way to draw close to me, to God. That's how he understands the purpose of korban, the purpose of an offering. Now, again, there's a lot to discuss about the purpose of offerings. We've talked about that in other series. But the point is that once I understand that the goal of korban, the goal of offering is for me to draw close to God, then I also understand that that's something that can be accomplished in additional ways. Not to replace the offering, but to accomplish what the offering is meant to accomplish, which is to say, to bring me closer to God. You know, it's an interesting thing. The offerings that we have all have names. There are names for each type of korban one brings. And generally speaking, the name of the offering is not the type of animal that is brought, or grain in the case of flour offerings. Rather, it's based on the relationship involved. So one type of korban is korban todah, a korban of thanks. Another type of korban is called a chatat, a sin offering for a person who committed a sin. Another one is called a shlamim, which is a peace offering, and it's usually also celebration. The offerings have names that are tied to the relationship involved, because as Rambam says, as Maimonides says here, that's really the point of the korban. It's the relationship with God. And so what the prophet Hosea is telling us in source number 3 is that our goal in reciting this, in reciting these words, is to complete our offerings, and in a day when we don't have offerings, it's to play the same role of bringing ourselves close to God. And so we have pages 33 to 45 that follow the order of service. We mimic the Kohen, we mimic the priest, starting with the hand washing and working our way through the incense. We imitate what the Kohen would do. Now, in terms of the history of when this became part of the Siddur, bless you, based on source number 4 in the Midrash, and Vayikra Rabbah is a fairly old body of Midrash dating back to the Second Temple period, and based on the Talmudic passage, which I did not quote, but says roughly the same thing as source number 4, it would seem that this is part of our prayer service since at least the time of the Second Temple. The idea that Jews everywhere would be reciting verses associated with offerings is a very old Jewish practice. Even though at that stage you don't have a siddur, so how are people going to do it? They have to memorize the verses. Or write them down. Remember that we said a while back, I think it was in the first week, that the sages were not happy with people writing down prayers. Nonetheless, someone might have recorded these verses and said, okay, that's what I'm going to read it from. Incidentally, if you jump to page 507, 507, this is the Amidah that's recited on Shabbat for the part of the service called Musaf. Remember that we have three regular daily prayers: morning, afternoon, and evening. The morning and afternoon parallel the daily offerings that were brought in the temple. The evening one parallels what they did at the end of the day, where they used to take the parts of the day's offerings and put them up on the altar. Musaf is recited on holidays, days that have a special biblical offering. Rosh Chodesh, the first day of the Jewish month, Pesach Shavuot. I have to pick either Ashkenaz or Sephardi to stick with it. Pesach, Shavuos, Sukkos, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur. Those are the days that have Musaf, that have a special offering. And if you take a look on page 507, you see what happens here. In the middle of the Amidah for Musaf, you get the verses that talk about the special offering brought on that day. On Yom Kippur, you may remember the Avodah. Right? The Avodah is the central part of the Musaf Amidah, part of the repetition of it. In many synagogues, traditionally, people actually bow down to the floor at a certain point when they're reciting it, mimicking what went on in the temple when this offering was brought, at the time when the Kohen Gadol would recite his prayers. This is a central part of how we pray in general. And so, what we see here is use of biblical verses, as well as back in the Karbanot section we saw initially in 33 to 45, Talmudic explanation of those verses. But we're using the verses as, I don't think it's exactly a form of prayer, but I think that it is a way to orient ourselves towards drawing closer to God by reciting the verses for the offerings that we aren't able to bring. The offerings were meant as a step towards God, so now we will recite those verses. Now, Leah had said before that if your intent when you're reciting verses is indeed to draw closer to God, then why wouldn't it be a prayer? It would be a prayer, and I think that's true. I think that can be true here. I think there are many people who have a harder time when reading verses about bringing in an animal as a korban. They have a harder time getting into it emotionally, so to speak, and feeling like this is what, this is a prayer. But I think even for someone who's going to have difficulty with the idea of karban, of sacrifice, as something that brings them closer to God, nonetheless, the idea is still we recite these verses and understand that this is traditionally the way that Jews came close to God, and that this is our mission in the course of our prayer, is we are here to try to do that. We are here to try to develop that relationship. Is that part clear? Okay?
Why is there a difference between the Sephard order and the Ashkenaz order in terms of the Karbanot? Now I think in Ashkenaz Minyanim it's not even so common to get into the Karbanot in the same way that the Sephard.
Right. Good. Right.
But is that just something that evolved culturally within those communities, or is there have they made a decision, religious decision, about where it should go?
Right. So as far as I know, and I prayed in both minyanim, Ashkenaz and Sephard are the same for the Karbanot. However, what Sephard does differently is that they also say them at mincha, at the afternoon service. They will actually say the Karbanot before starting mincha, where Ashkenazim do not. So that's one difference. And then a second difference is that in Israel, and in Eidot Mizrach in general, they actually don't include it in the synagogue service. They'll start the synagogue service right after that with the section we're about to get to called Psukei DeZimra, and they'll say those earlier verses at home. And the replacement for that in Ashkenazi synagogues, unfortunately, is to say pages 33 to 45 so quickly that they might as well have said them at home. Unfortunately, people do tend to rush through them, and it makes it very difficult to have the concentration that one needs. But in terms of your broader question of the Ashkenaz-Sfarad split, because I did want to get to that at some point in this series, basically what happens is, we're going to talk a little bit at the end about the Gaonic period, the period from the 7th to the 10th century, when Jews who have questions about Jewish law and what they're supposed to be doing, right away their questions to the Gaon, who is the head of one of the academies, one of the yeshivot. There was one in North Africa, they had some in under the Persians in what had been Babylon. That's the way they get their answers, and as a result, practice is relatively unified. Relatively, because realistically, communication being what it was, you couldn't all ask all of your questions and get the answers that you needed. But nonetheless, it was relatively centralized. The period right after that, you have the Crusades come along, number one. And number two, you have the splintering at the same time of Jewish communities throughout Europe. And the Crusades destroy the line of communications, and there's a growth instead of the idea of local authority. Your local rabbinic authority is the one who's going to answer your question. And smaller local yeshivot academies form as well. And the result is that people who are living in North Africa, or people who are living in Spain, or people who are living in Germany, or in Italy, or all the various lands where Jews are living, start to ask their questions locally. And so the liturgy, while never fully changing, the main structure that we're going to see today is true across the board. The choice of which psalms to say is largely identical. The position of Karbanot, Psukei Zimra, Shema, is largely the same. But in small ways, communities do start to differ, and it's based on geographic location. So you have North Africa develop one approach, Spain approach has another, Italy has another, the Ashkenazi lands centered around Germany have another, and that's how it ends up splitting. It's largely lack of communication between the communities, and the growth of local rabbinic authority is responsible for this development. Okay, that's our first section, is what I like to think of as historical prayer, reciting these verses of the Karbanot. That brings us to the second section, which is pages 61 to 87. I'm skipping the area in between, 47 to 59, because that's really here for a different reason. In a nutshell, that section is here because one is supposed to study some Torah every day, and that section provides a section of Mishnah, the building block of the Talmud, and then Gemara, the development of the Talmud beyond the Mishnah. And that's what that's there for, to make sure that you study a little bit every day. It's not really about prayer, it's about making sure you studied. So we then reach the section that you find on page 61. Now here, Ashkenazim and Sephardim do differ a little bit, in that this section we're about to see is called Psukei Dezimra, and it's a collection of verses that we'll see are meant to provide motivation for prayer, inspiration for prayer, in fact. And where the Sfarad edition, which is what you have in front of you, begins with some of those psalms and some of those verses before having a blessing called Baruch She'amar, and then more of the verses, and then a closing blessing of Yishtabach. The Ashkenazi version of it begins with the blessing of Baruch Shamar, then has all of the verses, and then has Yishtabach at the end. It's a question about where you place the blessing for reasons that I'm not going to go through right now. But take a look, please, at source number 7. Source number 7 is a great article that was referred to by a friend of mine in my community before I moved to Toronto. He was very insistent on the idea that committee meetings, board meetings, have to be run well, and that there are certain things that we can do to help them run well. One of the points that he made, he was quite correct. People forever talked about running the synagogue as a business. Run it like a business. But what they really meant was we should charge people a lot of money. They didn't know what running something like a business actually meant, because the people who were saying it had never run businesses. When you run something like a business, it means that you're user-friendly, customer-friendly, efficient in your operation, things like that. That's running something like a business. And he had much more to say about it. He was great. But take a look at this piece of an article about how meetings are run at Intel. At Intel Corporation, those who call a meeting must first assess whether the meeting is necessary. It's a novel idea. They'll email ideas to a few people for comments and suggestions, draft an agenda, then distribute it to a wider audience for revisions. The result is a one-pager containing the meeting's purpose and goals, subtopics with timeframes for each, a list of attendees, and what each one should bring to the table. It's distributed in advance to attendees and to the appropriate business unit chief, who might later check it for quality. We know from experience that 80% of the hard work gets done before the meeting even begins, says Michael Fors, Intel's corporate employee development manager. We're all responsible for using our time effectively, and we're aware of the opportunity costs. Makes perfect sense. Remarkable how little it's employed, but it makes perfect sense. What I see here, aside from a good lesson for how Jewish organizations should function, is also a message for prayer. Because the question, of course, is, do we do this before we have our meeting with God? Have we prepared the agenda before we met with God? Was there a point where you sat down and said, here's what I'm thinking about today, here's what I want to ask for, here's what, whatever it is, you know, fill in the blank, here's what I want to say thank you for. Is there that kind of mindfulness, which I think is the right word for this, before one enters tefillah, before one enters prayer? My father taught me to come on time for davening, for prayer. And that doesn't mean you walk in at 9 o'clock if it's supposed to start at 9 o'clock. It means that you're there in advance of 9 o'clock, so that you're actually able to think about what you're doing and get yourself settled in, as opposed to just, you know, rushing in, to say nothing of coming in late. This is part of the way that, you know, frankly, it's part of respect for what you're doing in general. Just, you know, forget the issue of preparing for what you're doing, but it's an issue of respect for it. And it makes you able to do your job well, so to speak. When I was in rabbinical school at Yeshiva University, one of the best things that I was ever able to participate in was a 3-week course, if you will, on visiting hospitals and visiting Shiva homes. And the person who taught it was Rabbi Maurice Lamb, who you may have heard of, author of Jewish Way in Death and Mourning, as well as other books. And the most valuable thing I took away from it was simply that before you walk in, know what you want to talk about, know what you want to say. Take a few minutes outside first, because it's remarkable what people will say in a Shiva house.
Yeah, it is.
Because people feel like they're obligated to say something, they feel like they should be saying something, although that's not true, but they feel like they should, and so if there's a vacuum in the conversation, out comes the first thing that comes to mind, which, you know, is often entirely wrong. So that idea, though, you know, can apply when it comes to prayer as well. And in fact, traditionally it did. Take a look on your sheet at source number 8, please. A Mishnah in Brachot. When we say something is a Mishnah, that means that this is a source that was written down, canonized in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, but in fact dates back before it. That's just when it was finally written down. So here we get the following lesson. One may not rise to pray other than with a solemn mind. Early pious people would wait an hour before praying to focus their heart upon God. Now, I don't know what an hour actually means here. Because keep in mind, this is long before digital watches. So I don't think the point is to say that someone is sitting there with a clock and it's 60 minutes. The point is to say that they're taking a significant period of time to think first. The concept of an hour existed, but they did their hours differently. They didn't operate on a 24-hour clock. They operated on a daylight or nighttime 12-hour clock. So in other words, you divided up your period from sunrise to sunset by 12, and each 1/12th unit was an hour. And so the hours would be shorter during the day in the winter, and they would be longer during the day in the summer. So don't get caught up in the 1 hour question. The point is that they would first meditate. That's really what you're talking about. They would first focus themselves on what they were about to do. And that's what Psukei Dezimra, this section that we're talking about here on pages 61 to 87, is about. The words Psukei Dezimra are actually Aramaic. The word pasuk means a verse that we use in Hebrew also. And it literally means an interruption. It's like an interrupted section. It's an individual verse. And then Zimra admits of two possible translations. One is to prune, like when you cut back branches on something. And the other is, what's the more famous one?
Singing.
Song, right. I tend to think that song is what's meant here. This is meant to say verses of song. But some do point out that it has a pruning quality to it as you prune out foreign, you know, distractions and focus on what you want to actually accomplish in terms of your prayer. Nonetheless, I think song is probably, you know, the origin of it, particularly because, as you see, if you take a look at any of the pages that I've just mentioned, at the top they name the section. You see it says in English, Psukei de Zimra. So in the Hebrew, it ends with an aleph, with a hey. The fact that it ends in a hey means it's more likely Zimra, meaning song. If it was Zimra, meaning pruning, then it would be an Aramaic term, and it would end with an aleph. So more likely it's song. In any case, that's a side note. These passages that you see here, the bulk of them, as I said earlier, come from Psalms. Not all of them, but the bulk of them come from Psalms. And that is intentional. Using the verses of Psalms in particular for this preparation as we approach God is important because who is the traditional author of Psalms? Right, King David. King David plays every imaginable role in his life. He is, and I know that someone's going to be thinking of the story of Bathsheba. I'm not going there today. He is shepherd. He is warrior. He is singer. He is monarch. He's a fugitive. He's a father. He deals with anything and everything. He approaches God and at times is rebuffed. He approaches God and at times finds God accepting him. He is rebuked by prophets. He's embraced by prophets. He goes through, really, like the gamut of religious experience. And having experienced all of the troubles of this world, as well as the wonderful things that we find in this world, he retains his faith. And he composes beautiful poetry to God in Tanakh, leaving aside Psalms. When you read the books, you know, when you read the books of Shmuel, of Samuel, you find the songs that he composes. He composes beautiful poetry. And we use Psalms at all times, such as the current war, to approach God, because every mood is reflected therein. One of his themes in particular is so important when it comes to developing a mindset for prayer. If you take a look on your sheet, source number 9, this is a passage that is in fact included in Psukei de Zimra. But I took it out and put it on the page here, on number 9. David describes God as creator of heaven and earth, the sea, and all within them. Unclear if them refers to the sea or them refers to the heavens, earth, and sea. It doesn't matter for our purposes. Who guards truth forever. He performs justice for the oppressed. He gives bread to the hungry. God releases the imprisoned. What has he done here with God? What has he done to God here in his description?
He's made him omnipotent, the summary of his omnipotence.
Well, the first part of it is about divine might, for sure. And then?
He deals with our
particular... Exactly. He sees our personal needs, gives bread to the hungry, performs justice for the oppressed, releases the imprisoned. God is at once cosmic and personal. And that's a theme we see in Psalms repeatedly and in Psukei de Zimra repeatedly. And I think that, to my mind, is a critical theme for a Jew who wants to approach God for a personal conversation. To somehow reconcile the Carl Sagan, you know, billions and billions of stars with the idea that God is going to care about having some kind of audience for me. Is very important. And so this is a passage about appreciating the importance of ourselves and of the communication we're about to have. Now, in terms of history, if you look at source 8 again, it says Hasidim Harishonim in the Hebrew. Early pious people would do this. Which tells me that in the time of the Mishnah, in the 3rd century, it's not a universal practice. It's something that was known as something that some people had done. That's the way it's listed there. If you take a look at source number 10, we get another clue. A passage which also goes back to Mishnaic times. Brought in the Talmud from Rabbi Yossi, a scholar of the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi said, "May my portion be with those who complete Hallel each day." Hallel is a reference, we think, to chapters of Psalms that are used to praise God, usually used on special holidays. We say Hallel on festive occasions. So he says, "I want to be with those who complete Hallel each day." To which the Talmud questions, "Can this be? Didn't our master teach us one who recites Hallel each day is a blasphemer? Why would that be?" Because you get too used to it. It loses its meaning. If you say Hallel every day, it stops being Hallel. That's one explanation of the line. My main point, though, was his closing point here, to which when the Talmud resolves it and says, yes, but here he was referring to Psukei Dezimra. The Talmud says Rabbi Yossi was talking about Psukei Dezimra, what we're talking about here. And Rabbi Yossi was saying, I wish my portion should be, my portion in the next world he's talking about, my portion should be with those who say Psukei Dezimra every day. In other words, not everybody is saying it every day. It's a known thing. It exists, it has a name. But it's not daily for everybody at that stage. So at some point during the Talmudic period, somewhere between 1500 and 1800 years ago, maybe a little bit more recently than that, unclear, is when this becomes something that everybody is going to do. But this is our second section. And in terms of our question of using verses as a form of prayer, I think one certainly can see this as a form of prayer in and of itself. But to me, more important is that it is a preface to prayer. It's a way to get myself ready for prayer. Now, there's a lot of text in here. So just on a practical note, what I always tell people is, if you can concentrate for the entire section and all of it is going to work for you, that's wonderful. But what may be more useful is to pick out sections of it and say, this is what I'm going to focus on today. This is what's going to catch my eye and I'm going to think about today. Particularly because, as I've said on other occasions in other contexts, your biggest enemy in Psukei Dezimra is this book. In the sense that these beautiful poems are printed in paragraphs, like prose, at which point they lose all meaning. Because you could take the most wonderful Shakespearean sonnet and stick it in a paragraph form, and I wish you a lot of luck in understanding what he's talking about. It just loses the beauty. So, you have to acknowledge it's a little bit of an uphill battle thanks to the printers. There are those who have attempted to reprint them as poems. I believe the Koren edition is one that there are some here, which prints part of it in poetry, going down the page instead of paragraphs. Yeah. So that certainly is a boost. Okay, stage three, because we're getting towards time here. Stage three is Shema. People talk a lot about Judaism being deed rather than creed, the idea that it's about what you do, not what you believe. And there's something to be said for that. In comparing Judaism with other religious groups, we may have less of an obligatory creed than others do. However, there's no mistaking the fact that biblical text tells us what you think matters. If you take a look at source number 12, I brought you a couple of verses. One is the first of the Ten Commandments. I am the Lord your God who took you out from Egypt from the house of slaves. Some historically were so bothered by the idea that this should be a commandment that they actually said, no, that's just an introduction. The commandments start afterwards. But traditionally, that wasn't the way we looked at it. Traditionally, Jews understood this to be the first of the ten is, know that I am God who took you out of Egypt. The next line I brought you is from Deuteronomy. You shall know today, you shall put into your heart that Hashem is God in the heavens above and on the earth below. There is no other. And then, of course, the most famous statement of Jewish creed is Shema, in which we declare that God is one. But there's more to the Shema than that. If you flip in your Siddur to pages 95 to 99, the pages that I skipped from the end of Psukei DeZimrah until you get up to Shema, are blessings that were created to bracket the Shema. There are blessings before Shema, then there's a blessing after it, before the Amidah. I'm skipping those blessings in the interests of time and focusing on Shema itself, which is found at the bottom of page 95, and you see it's made of multiple paragraphs. It begins with, Hashem is our God, Hashem is one. You see the translation they gave, the one and only. It's a good translation. On page 97, it continues with the paragraph that immediately follows the verse of Shema in the Torah, which speaks of loving God. And then, in the next paragraph, it's acceptance of God's commandments and the understanding that there is reward and punishment. And then it concludes on page 99 with a paragraph that talks about remembering the commandments and knowing that God took us out of Egypt. Shema is fundamentally about belief. It is a biblical commandment. Unlike some of the other prayers we've been talking about, since the verse says, if you take a look on page 97, we are told to love God, let these matters that I command you today be upon your heart, teach them thoroughly to your children, and speak of them while you sit in your home, while you walk, when you retire, meaning go to sleep, and when you rise. So from that we understand, because it says to speak of them when you go to sleep, and when you get up, we understand that there's a biblical mitzvah of saying Shema in the morning, and then saying it again when in the evening at the time when people go to sleep. It's meant to provide us with a sense of what Jews believe in. And we use it right before the Amidah to state why we are approaching God. That's what I understand it to be here for. It is here to tell me why I'm approaching God. I saw in the first section that historically Jews did approach God with the Korban, and I say those verses as part of reliving that in some sense. In the second section, I get myself oriented, so to speak, in terms of how I'm going to approach God, what I'm asking for, what this relationship is about. And then in the third part, we have the justification for prayer. I am approaching God because this is my mitzvah of loving God, this is my mitzvah of having this relationship with God. Now, because this is biblical, from a history perspective, that means this is being recited by Jews as individuals from the beginning of Judaism. Group recitation, when did this become part of what everybody would say together instead of just what you could say at home, is an interesting question. If you take a look at source number 13 on your sheets, this is part of a section of the Mishnah, that early body of tradition, published in the beginning of the 3rd century Common Era, but written long before then. This source in particular is part of a section that describes what went on in the temple every single day. So this is describing now Jewish practice going back more than 2,000 years. And it says, the designee, there was a designee, then said to the Kohanim, to the priests, recite one blessing. And they did. They then recited the Ten Commandments. That was said every single day. Shema, Vahayayim Shamoa, and Vayomer. Those are the three paragraphs we just saw in the Shema, in the Sidur. And then they blessed the nation with the three blessings. Meaning Birkat Kohanim, right? The blessing of the priests. The initial blessing was a separate blessing that was meant as a preface for this one. It says, recite one blessing. The Ten Commandments fell out of the liturgy for a fascinating reason. There was concern that people would believe that that's the main thing. You don't need to worry about the rest of the Torah because that's what God told the Jews directly at Sinai. That's what matters. And so they took it out of the liturgy and said, we don't want to give it too much emphasis, so therefore it won't be said on a daily basis. Interestingly, there was also an objection to posting the Ten Commandments in synagogues for the same reason. And I always find that interesting because coming from the U.S., that's been litigated so much in the last 30 years of having the Ten Commandments in public places. Are you allowed to? Not allowed to? And at one point, the newspaper asked me, what do you think? And I said, actually, I don't think it should be posted at all, because we didn't post them. They should post the whole thing. They didn't take that. So Shema is recited as sort of a catechism, a collection of what we believe and what's behind our prayer altogether. The worth noting, just two points that people ask about a lot, so I thought I would mention them. In source number 14, people ask about the origin of covering one's eyes when saying the first line of the Shema. So in fact, you see it here in the Talmud, it is a story regarding Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who lives in the beginning of the 3rd century. One student says to another, "I didn't see him say Shema. He's been teaching us all morning, and he hasn't said Shema." To which the response was, "Child of kings," because he was someone who came from great lineage. So he says to him, "Child of kings, when he passes his hand over his face, he's reciting Shema. When he goes like this," it's not because you asked a silly question. When he goes like this, it's because he's actually saying Shema at that time. So when you see him go like this, that's what's going on. The origin of it is very simply to concentrate. You block out distractions. Making the effort of closing your eyes without putting your hands in front of your face is actually more distracting. It's easier if you just do this and you forget about it and then you can focus on what you're doing. That's the idea, at any rate. The other line that people ask about a lot is, if you look back on page 95, right after the opening sentence of the Shema, there's a verse that's put in there, Baruch Shem Kivod. What is that about and why is it said quietly? So in brief, in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple in Jerusalem, when someone declared the name of God in prayer, everybody would respond, Blessed be the name of God forever. Baruch Shem was the response to saying the name of God. So when the community declares as one, Shema Yisrael, when the community is going to say that all together, then the response comes, Baruch Shem Kavod. We are now answering that public declaration of God's name. You follow? That's the idea. So then why is it said quietly? So I brought you here on the sheet, source number 15, the response from the Talmud, which is because it doesn't appear in the Shema as the Shema appears in the Torah. Right? As the Shema appears in the Torah, in the Chumash, there's no Baruch Shem line. It goes straight from the verse of Hear, O Israel, of Shema Yisrael, right into the paragraph that's at the top of page 97. So it's not there, and it's sort of an offense to Moshe. Now, the Talmudic passage also alludes to a story regarding Yaakov, Jacob, and the idea that when he gathers his children to his deathbed, he's worried. It's a longer story than we have time for right now, but he's worried that they may not really have bought into what he's trying to teach them. And so, they say to him, Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel. Israel being another of his names, he's named Yisrael. I can't believe I stuck in the O. That's the Irish Jew, O Israel. Hear, Israel. Hashem is one. We believe in what you've been trying to teach us. And he responds, blessed be God's name. He's grateful for this. That's another element of this. But the point is that it's said quietly because it doesn't appear in the Chumash. So it's odd to be putting this in. So we do it quietly, other than, of course, on Yom Kippur, when it is said aloud. So this is the third section of the three. Now, I wanted to take another 2 minutes to talk about history of the Sidur, and then, as I said in the beginning, I'm going to stay around to talk about what's going on in Israel and some of the issues that we're seeing. So those who can stay, please do, and we'll also say a little bit of Tehillim, of Psalms, that's our form of prayer and in a time of war. But in terms of the Sidur itself and how the Sidur came to be, because right now we're talking about things that happened 2,000, 2,500 years ago that Jews were saying, but there was no Sidur. No one actually had a book. So when does it become a book and why? And the answer seems to be, it's with the period of the Gaonim. The Gaonim are the heads of the central yeshivot, the central academies, from the 7th century until the 10th century, in that period of centralization. And the Gaonim deal with individual questions, but also policy issues, issues for the nation as a whole. And one of their central problems was the movement of the Karaites. That was a major problem for them. The Karaites were believers in the idea that rabbinic tradition is no stronger than, no more legitimate than, what I choose to say. I learned the verses and this is my idea. And there were great fights, great disputes involving Karaism. And one possibility, and I think it's a strong possibility historically, is that the Gaonim created the Sidur in response to the Karaites, because the Karaites were challenging various elements of our liturgy. We don't need to say that. We want to say it this way. We want to do it this way. And so what you do is you put together a text and say, this is the definitive way of doing things. So that Rav Natronoi ben Hillel Gaon, I listed three Gaonim for you in source 17. He was the head of the academy in a city called Sura, early in the second half of the 9th century. His father held the position for 30 years. He, Rav Natronoi, was not the direct successor of his father. There was someone in between. And so he was actually rather old when he entered office. He only served less than a decade, which is unusual. Gaonim tended to serve longer. But he has a great number of responsa that still survive to this day. Questions from everywhere, and many of them are regarding liturgy. And much of his work, in fact, is response to the Karaites, and he is the first, I believe, who we have on record recording prayers in writing for people to use. We don't have a sidur from him, though. Yeah?
How many people actually were able to read?
Apparently quite a number based on the literature that we have of responsa literature, and based on what's been found in the Cairo Geniza, where they have all these documents that they're now unearthing from that time, literacy was pretty good. I have no idea of total numbers or percentage of the population, which it would be good to know. But there's quite a bit of literacy at that point. Rabbi Amram Gaon is also in Persia in the 9th century in the city of Sura. He was the first to actually arrange a complete liturgy for the synagogue. It was called a seder, which evolves into being called sidur. But it was actually seder, meaning order, arrangement. And his seder takes the form of a responsum he sends to the Jews of Spain. It's the foundation of much of what we have in our sidur, in our prayer book. We don't have any early manuscripts of what he sent them. Well, we have our later manuscripts, which seem to have been edited later on so that people put in what they do into this sidur. So it's hard to know exactly what was in the original and what was added in later on. But we know that he did, in fact, send a sidur to the Jews of Spain in response to their questions about what they're supposed to be doing. The third one I was going to mention, and I am mentioning, is Rabbi Sadja Gaon. Rabbi Sadja Gaon, there's way too much that needs to be said about him, but he's in the 10th century, he's born in Egypt, then he goes to Persia. He was one of the central figures, if not the central figure, in leading traditional Judaism in his period. He wrote Emunot V'Deyot, a work in Arabic on Jewish philosophy. I'm not going to start because I won't stop. But he transcribed the prayers for weekdays, Shabbat, for holidays, into a form of Sidur. It also includes his poetry and a commentary he wrote on it in Arabic. There is no full manuscript of their entire text. The Oxford Library has a near complete manuscript. Fragments of it have also been found in Cairo in the Geniza that they discovered a little over a century ago. And his prayer book served as a basis for later efforts to codify our ritual and set it down in writing. And it was imitated then by those who came along later. So the answer to the question of, so where does the Sidur come from, is a little complicated. The prayers that are in it originate centuries before it's actually written down. Second Temple times, we already know that they have Shema with a blessing. We already know that they have the Karbanot and the verses of the Karbanot being said. And some people are saying Psukei Dezimra, not everybody. That's post-Second Temple. We don't know how far afterwards. And then, centuries later, it pops up in this Sidur that is provided in writing for everybody to use. So, to summarize what we saw today, much of our Sidur is actually composed of biblical verses, which we see as a form of liturgy, as a form of prayer, meant to inculcate certain ideas into us and to help us to approach God. You have the Korban, the historical way of praying and drawing close to God. Psukei Dezimra, motivation for prayer, inspiration for prayer. And Shema, which explains why we pray. It's the relationship that is the foundation for the prayer, all leading into the Amidah. There is, of course, much more to say. Surprise. But we're going to stop here for now. If you can't stay, I'm certainly not insulted or upset. Upset maybe, but not insulted. But what we'll do, for those who are able to stay, if you can get a Siddur, is first we'll do a little bit of Tehillim.